It's a great week to be doing This Week in Law because it's been a big week. Yesterday, we had the new open internet rules proposed. We've got Nilay Patel and Baron Soka here to discuss that in depth. We'll cover everything from Commissioner Clyburn's mom to the chairman's scars as an entrepreneur and finally give you the nuances and difficulties of Title I versus Title II. Then we'll move on, fly across the pond to the EU, where we have Professor Maria Murphy joining us to talk about the right to be forgotten. All that and more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 259, recorded May 16th, 2014. Maniac or Political Mastermind. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like mango almond bites. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hey, folks, I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law on a particularly great week to be discussing technology law, because lots of important things have been happening and we have some incredible people to help us try and understand and unpack those events. One of them is Nilay Patel, longtime friend of the show. Great to see you back, Nilay.
Hey, it's great to be here. It's been too long.
I know, it's been really too long. Evan, by the way, folks, Evan Brown, my co-host, is not able to join us this week. He will be back next week, at which point I will be out. So we're kind of tag teaming the show these couple of weeks here. But also going to join us for this opening segment of the show is Baron Soka from Tech Freedom. Baron, however, is in transit right now. He's going to have to join us in a few minutes. We're going to go ahead and kick off the discussion, though, because yesterday there was a hearing at the FCC that has long-reaching ramifications on net neutrality. So we're going to go ahead and kick off the discussion and add Baron in to finish out that part of the show, and we're going to move on to some privacy considerations about the right to be forgotten in the UK and some other issues in the bottom half of the show. So let's start out on the important policy issue of net neutrality. All right, Nilay, I'm sure you have watched, seldom have I ever watched a clip of C-SPAN footage with such rapt attention. Hearing yesterday at the FCC proposing the new open internet order, the FCC commissioners voted to put the proposed order on the table. There will be a lengthy discussion and reply period starting now and ending in September, at which time they will decide whether to enact the order as written or tweak it further to respond to comments and concerns raised in that reply period. So what were the high points of the hearing for you yesterday, Nilay?
Just how contentious it was. You know, the vote was 3-2 on party lines. So Wheeler's Democrat, McDonnell Clyburn, and Jessica Rosenworcel are Democrats. They've all voted for the proposal. But in both of their comments, Clyburn and Rosenworcel said basically, like, I don't want to do this. And, you know, Wheeler as chairman, if anything, no one disagrees, he is a force, right? He's getting things done. He's insistent that we not dilly-dally and that we move forward. And so to me, the most interesting thing yesterday was to assuage the fears that, you know, that these new rules would create paid prioritization and fast lanes and the end of the world. Wheeler explicitly said, well, I also want comment on whether we should just go ahead and reclassify broadband under Title II as a common carrier, which to me is I can't tell if he's a maniac or if he's like a political mastermind that he keeps irritating people into pushing him into doing what needs to be done, but that he might not have the political capital to do otherwise. So to me, yes, what I saw yesterday was three commissioners of the FCC voting for a plan that maybe they don't like. They definitely know the public doesn't like it, but also proposing in the alternative the plan that kind of everybody wants and saying, well, tell us if we should go with that instead. So I was watching it and I found myself wondering like how we arrived at such a broken political process that everybody kind of knows what should be done. Everybody definitely knows what the 18,000 people who filed comments on the docket want. But nobody's doing that quite yet because we have to yell about it a little bit longer. But now procedurally, the door is open for that yelling to be effective. And, you know, that's one of those like democracy is the worst system except for all the other ones moments. But it would be right. But it was very interesting to watch sort of everybody knows this isn't what the proper outcome should be. This is definitely what Comcast wants. But as an internet user, it's very clear that people don't want this. But we've got to endure, you know, two more 60-day comment periods before we can possibly get to the right answer.
All right. Well, let's unpack some of that. First off, it sounds like you had the same reaction that I did when Chairman Wheeler said at one point, I know the founding fathers are looking down on us right now and smiling.
Sure.
Really?
Yeah. George Washington is looking down on you and being like, I should have just appointed a king to make the right decision right away. Like,
I think probably some of them are saying, well, what's this FCC thing? We didn't plan on that being there.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's part of their problem, right? They're floundering around trying to decide what authority to enact this under. They're trying to carefully read the Federal Circuit's decision from earlier this year so that they can continue to proceed under 706. As you mentioned, they're asking for comment on proceeding under their other possible legal ground, Title II, but without going into the whole lengthy history of what 706 is and what Title II is. I know, Nilay, you are ardently following Susan Crawford into the breach on the Title II front. So maybe you can explain. I think you think it's incredibly obvious that the internet should be treated as a common carrier. So why don't you give us some background on that and what it means and why you think the FCC should take that approach?
The short version is that originally the FCC under Michael Powell classified broadband as an information service for fairly silly reasons. The broadband providers at the time, internet service providers in general at the time, said, well, we're not just delivering broadband. We're giving you free email addresses and ways to host your own website. And we'll have these great video offerings that like disrupt our own, you know, they made all these promises about what services they would actually deliver. But it turns out that broadband companies suck at providing services and nobody wants them. To this day, when I get an email from somebody and their email address is like @comcast.net, like I literally assume that I'm dealing with somebody who isn't sophisticated enough to know they should sign up for a Gmail account. And they're, they're like accepting a bad service because they just don't know any better, which, you know, that's the beauty of the internet, right? If you have a bad service, there's competition just one click away. At that moment, when we decided that broadband providers were providing information services would be lightly regulated under Title I, we made a fundamental mistake about the value of internet service and what it actually is. And I think that the internet service broadband is like a window to a free marketplace, not a bundle of related services in addition to internet access and, you know, video on demand and cable television and VoIP. You know, these are things that the broadband companies really want to bundle together. They really want to sell you all kinds of things. But what you really want, what most people really just need, is sort of just undifferentiated access to the free market of the internet. And I think we've just been fighting against that for years and years, even as broadband companies like Comcast are just getting bigger and bigger and more powerful and more vertically integrated. And as they get more vertically integrated, and as Comcast, you know, they bought NBC, now they own the content, they own the distribution across two of the most powerful distribution networks of information ever devised, television and the internet. And they want to buy Time Warner Cable, which will make them the dominant provider in 19 of 20 markets, the 20 biggest markets in America. So that, to me, just looks like the AT&T of old, which is literally what Title II was designed to regulate. And AT&T of old became huge, became powerful, interestingly, people loved the old regulated AT&T, right? They, Ma Bell, like it was a concept because they were providing good service to people, and they were providing good service to people across the country, right? Whereas I think people hate Comcast because Comcast has no restriction, it has no regulation. It can provide bad service to people for high prices. Time Warner Cable in New York City is just legendary. I mean, New York City is an island, Manhattan's an island, right? It's a small place. The idea that Time Warner Cable can't figure out how to adequately provide service across the tiny landmass of Manhattan is crazy, but they can't. I don't know why. And I think the reason is they don't have any incentive to, there's no competition. There's no incentive to compete here and provide better service for lower prices. And as long as there's no fundamental competition in the market for what is, I think, a necessary necessary public good for our economy, then we should look to a more stringent regulatory regime. And that's the entire Title II argument. I think the information services argument, the Title I argument, the don't touch this, things are going fine, is it's predicated on illusory notions of competition. I really don't think most people feel that they can go to a service provider other than Comcast or Time Warner, RCN, in their homes to get the fastest possible broadband. And, you know, I don't think that wireless services like Verizon LTE or what have you are remotely ready to be meaningful competitors to wired broadband.
Isn't there a third option here that the two, at least one of the two, dissenting, no voting commissioners referred to, and that's Congress, who put us in this boat to begin with. Well, they didn't because they can't gaze into their crystal ball and see the future with much clarity at all. But the reason that we're having this debate over Title I versus Title II is that nobody knew what to make of the internet or what it would become. And now we're trying to cram it into one of those two boxes. And maybe we need Congress to say, look, now we understand the internet, at least we understand it as it is today. It gets its own box. And here's how we should regulate it. Would that help matters, do you think?
Yes. I mean, in the sense that writing a perfect law always helps matters. But I think reality says that you're not going to write a perfect law. And in the meantime, this vibrant economic engine is going to be, you know, harmed by service providers. Look, I don't blame Comcast or Time Warner or any of the or AT&T or Verizon for trying to extract value from their investments. They should do it. They should do it with, you know, vigor, and they should try to gain as much revenue as they can from their massive infrastructure investments. The problem is that that incentive is at odds with the public good that we need to receive from the internet, which is a free market, right? Like a real no walls, no barriers to entry free market. And so if they're going to raise the opportunity cost for new entrepreneurs in that market, we should figure out how to stop it right away before we, you know, let Congress sit around and draft a perfect bill that will foster innovation. You know, like that's crazy. You know, and what's actually really interesting to me is the day that the 2010 rules were struck down in court was the same day, I believe, that or the day before that Congress began a committee session on a new telecom act. And so the process is happening. Congress knows it wants to draft one of these things. It's just going to take them 5 years. And I think the FCC kicking its responsibility to a legislative body that has already offered it the authority to do these things is that, you know, there's a reason this was decided on party lines. And I think the two commissioners are the Republican commissioners. They don't favor any regulations at all. And of course, I mean, just that's of course what they're going to say. You know, we don't want to impose regulations. If Congress wants them, it should impose them itself. And that's fine, but that's predicted. But I think it's an abdication of the FCC's responsibility to protect the market and act in the consumer interest.
So waiting for Congress would be punting by the FCC, you think?
Yeah, punting. And I do think there's an argument to be made. It's very wonky, and it, you know, if you do the line reading of Title II, you can make the argument that it was designed to anticipate broadband. It wasn't designed just for telephone service. Now, the cable companies will argue tooth and nail that that is not true, but I think that argument is there. I think that's the reason the FCC is willing to consider it. That's the reason they're willing to say we're going to impose Title II, but, you know, use our forbearance authority to get rid of all the regulations that don't make any sense here and just apply the ones that we want to impose the free market principles of net neutrality.
Okay, so they've got on the table at least getting comments on reclassification. But it, in the event they don't go that way, Neeli, do you think, and now I realize that this new proposed order is nearly 200 pages long. I certainly haven't begun to unpack it and am glad that the comment period goes until September.
Right.
But to the extent you've looked at the proposal in any detail yet, do you think that the commissioner has adequately skirted the boundaries of 706 such that this would hold up under Title I?
I think it will hold up under Title I. The problem is that how they're doing it, I think, is it's a hack, right? I mean, fundamentally what they're doing is the court offered them 706 authority and said, okay, you definitely have the authority to regulate broadband under 706, which basically just says, you know, the FCC should promote the deployment of broadband in America. So that I think that's a hazy authority to begin with. But anyway, the court said they have it. No one's pushing it. Everyone's willing to see how far that can go. And the way they're sort of Wheeler's plan to get to net neutrality principles is to say, okay, well, you can do paid prioritization, you can do fast lanes, you can do all the stuff we don't want you to do, but you can't do it in a way that isn't commercially reasonable. And that is an undefined phrase as far as I can tell. There's obviously no precedent under these rules for what that means. And it's a big wait and see game. And Wheeler's promise is, well, I'm going to make sure that if the providers are doing bad things, that I'll be there. I'll be watching. You know, yesterday, his comments were very personal. He responded, Mignon Clyburn said, my mom called me about net neutrality, which is the first time in my career as a commissioner that my mother cares about telecom policy. And Wheeler responded during his remarks, said, well, if we're doing personal remarks, let me have a personal remark. And his was, as an entrepreneur and a venture capitalist, I know what happens when markets are closed. I've had businesses destroyed by it, and I'm going to be on guard, right? I'm going to be ready to make sure that things are commercially reasonable, which is great if Tom Wheeler is the king of the FCC for the rest of time, but not so great from a policy perspective when administrations will change, when political parties will change, when Silicon Valley, the powers that be there, the large companies, their alliances might change. Google and Verizon used to be best friends, and now they hate each other. These things happen, and you need a policy, I think, that can withstand just the changing landscape of our time. So I think it's interesting that his plan is basically, as near as I can tell it, this plan establishes the closest thing you can get to net neutrality under 706. He's saying, I will be the guardian of the open internet as long as I'm here. And then what is particularly interesting to me, and this might factor into that rewriting the Telecom Act of Congress piece, Comcast itself has promised to abide by the 2010 rules, which were struck down, but they've agreed to abide by them until 2018. And if they buy Time Warner Cable, they've agreed that Time Warner Cable will abide by them as well. So we've got the largest broadband provider in the country agreeing to the rules that we liked before until 2018. So there's a little bit of runway here for Wheeler to say, well, I'm going to impose the rules I can. We can have a bigger fight about Title II. And in the meantime, while I'm kicking the can down the road here, Congress can look at other stuff and Comcast has to play nice. And that, again, I can't tell if he's a total maniac and he lucked into this moment or if he's a political genius, right? Like, it's one or the other. I don't think there's a middle ground.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about one of the big pieces that they're seeking comment on, and this would be an expansion from the proposed 2010 rules, is whether or not open internet rules should apply to both wired and wireless connectivity. Right. The wireless piece has always been outside the purview. Was not part of the 2010 rules, and I did not pay a ton of attention at the time as to why exactly it was carved out. I'm assuming because the wireless carriers made the case that they needed that they were a newer market and newer technology and had spectrum issues that Perhaps the wired carriers did not have to confront, although everyone confronts spectrum issues, and somehow made the case to the FCC that they needed to be left alone a bit longer. Apparently, because the FCC is now, as Commissioner Clyburn said, taking this opportunity from the D.C. Circuit to actually revisit the whole piece and see whether it should be made even more expansive, that could change. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're characterizing it exactly right. I think when the 2010 rules were being promulgated, there was, I didn't agree with it, but there was a strong argument that, I think Julie Shinokowski, the FCC chairman at the time, said wireless is different, right? And if you just look at the market at that time, you know, the iPhone was new-ish. It was 2-3 years on the market. LTE wasn't available. You know, mobile broadband was a nascent idea. The United States in particular is just absolutely miserable at standardizing on mobile. So you had Sprint running in one direction with WiMAX, which cost them $1 billion and probably will result in the utter destruction of their business one day. AT&T running on one kind of LTE, Verizon beating everybody to market with another kind of LTE, T-Mobile saying we don't have any spectrum, all these regional carriers who are doing whatever it is they're doing. So that market was a mess at that time. And I think saying, okay, we're just going to leave this alone until we sort it out was fair. I think if you had any sort of vision into the future, you would know we'd end up right where we landed, which is we have several dominant carriers. We have lots of consolidation happening with the smaller carriers to the point where Sprint and T-Mobile really desperately want to merge with each other, even though they kind of like they're saying they don't want to. And you've got incompatible systems, but what you really, really, you know, you can't go from AT&T to Verizon, which I think is ridiculous, right? But what you also have is you have entire generations of consumers who now consume the internet over mobile broadband on mobile devices as their primary point of contact. And that particularly is young people, and it's particularly less wealthy people. And it's kind of like a regressive tax on the poor for us to say, well, we're going to let Verizon create whatever kind of internet it wants on mobile, but make sure that the rules are great for Fios. Because the reality is that the people at Fios are more wealthy than people who rely just on Verizon's LTE service in the aggregate, right? So that I think it's the moment is here for us to say, okay, well, mobile broadband really is fundamentally the same as fixed broadband, right? You're doing the same things. Maybe you're doing it on slightly different devices. Maybe you're using apps instead of the native web all the time, but it is the same, right? The activities are the same. The speeds are in large part the same, and there's no reason to not think about them in the same way. Because for all the argument about the spectrum crunch, it has never materialized. I think wireless carriers are excellent at making it seem like the sky is going to fall on them at any minute. But the reality is they've been delivering better products every year.
Do you think that, I mean, it sounded like Commissioner Wheeler's comments could be construed as putting ISP's feet to the fire on their guaranteed levels of service. And I may be reaching here, but it sounds like he was almost concerned that perhaps today people aren't getting the internet service that they've paid for, and that the ISPs have too much wiggle room in the varying degrees of service. You know, you have up to 15 down and 2 up or whatever, and based on network traffic and acts of God, that's going to vary. Do you think that this will put any more teeth into those service level agreements?
You know, I do, but in the sense that like now we have to start litigating the agreements, or the FTC has to start litigating it. Wheeler's entire approach seems to be, I'll make rules that don't prescribe any behavior, but in a strong way. But if you break my vague rules, let's litigate it out, and I'll be the judge to make sure you're doing what you say. And that has basically been his strategy because he's trying to proceed under 706. That is kind of where his strategy is, because his authority is promote broadband deployment in the United States. So he's got to he doesn't have authority to impose regulation. In Title II would let him say, you can do this, you can't do that. Here are your price controls. Here's your investment subsidy, right? Here's all the stuff we use to build the telephone network. Under 706, he's got to get, someone's got to get mad. There needs to be a court case. The FCC has to do something. And the resolution has to be, okay, Comcast, you can't advertise these speeds and then not deliver them because that is not promoting broadband deployment in the United States. And I think that is, that's, it's elliptical, right? And I think that's the real problem. I do applaud the fact that he wants these companies to deliver what they're promising, but he's got a, he's just setting himself up for a very long road, in a very litigious road.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. So let's look at, we have him talking about the minimum level. There's not going to be a slow lane. You're going to get what you paid for. How do you think the fast lane would work?
The analogy that I've been using, maybe you disagree with this. I'm actually curious to see what you think about it. I'm using the airport security. That's just how I think about it. When you think about going to the airport, the TSA has no competition, right? You can't go through a different security system. And they've created a minimum level of service where you take off your shoes, you got your belt, you pull your laptop out, and it's awful and everybody hates it. And they probably don't need it, right? You can argue that it's security theater. And the TSA often, promote, there is a fast lane. You can sign up for pre-check, right? And they promote pre-check by letting everybody into the fast lane periodically, which to me raises the question, like, why do I have to take off my shoes all the time if sometimes I don't, right? And I haven't signed up for pre-check. You're just letting me experience dignity and saying, well, if you pay me $85 and give me your fingerprints, you can have this dignity all the time. And that's, they have no incentive to fix the minimum level of service because they're trying to push people. They have incredible incentives to push people into paying for the better service. And I think that analogy is just how I think about fast lanes on the internet for gigantic behemoth service providers who have intrinsic monopolies with wires in the ground and no real competition. So yeah, Comcast will say you're going to get your 15 megs down and your 1 meg up, and they're just going to leave that there forever and say, if you want more, if you want better access to Netflix, you got to pay us $5 more. And I don't know why they wouldn't do that. I cannot think of an incentive for them to fix the minimum level of service or to increase it or to improve it when all of their incentives are to create more revenue out of the same infrastructure investment by saying, but you can get better X for a price of Y.
So back to Title II for a second. But first, before we go back to Title II, I have to drop an MCLE passphrase into the show, and experiencing dignity is a great one. So let's use that. For those of you who are listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit, we drop these passphrases into the show as our very high-tech, sophisticated way of providing verification. Trust, but verify. Our first one is experiencing dignity. We'll put another one later in the show. And if you want more information about receiving such credit for listening to or watching This Week in Law, head on over to the TwitWiki at wiki.twit.tv. We've got a whole page over there for you under the This Week in Law show. Let's talk about Title II for a second. The big complaint, knock on Title II. Nilay is number one. It would be politically unpopular. It would be much lobbied against. And so a difficult thing to hang the FCC's authority on. And one of the reasons it would be politically unpopular is the ISPs claim they would be hamstrung by the additional regulation. And you pointed out earlier, the FCC can forbear. It doesn't have to enforce all of the various aspects of that title. It can selectively decide what would apply. But you were talking a moment ago about the ISPs not having an incentive to invest. Would their incentive to invest be lessened if they had to do something like provide universal access?
You know, it's hard to say what Comcast thinks of its current incentives are, right? And so it's hard to, I think if you look at Comcast's total investment, and actually on Vox.com, our site, Matt Iglesias posted a great chart that the NCTA, the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, they posted one of these cumulative investment charts, so it can only go up, right? So they're like, cumulative investment 2002 to 2010 is skyrocketing. And it's like, well, yeah, you just keep adding the bars. Like, of course it's going up. Like, it's, you're literally, your cumulative investment over any X period of time has to be higher than the previous X period of time, because you're adding the previous period of time to the current period of time. But if you look at what they're actually doing, their investment is falling because they've saturated huge markets in America. They are providing a service that people need. It's not want. You don't want broadband in your home. You need it. To participate in a modern economy, you need broadband in your home, whether it's mobile or wired. But you need access to the internet to participate in our economy as like a first-tier worker. In general, in life, to sign up for health insurance in America right now, you know what you need to do? You need to get to healthcare.gov. You know how you do that? You do it over the internet. So you need this service now in your life. And they've providing it to a huge swath of people. They, like I said, they don't have competition. So their investment, if you look at what their actual dollars are, their investments are falling. Verizon, this is actually my favorite story. Verizon promised the state of New Jersey they would wire almost all the homes in New Jersey with Fios. And to lay the wires in the ground, they ran around saying fiber is a Title II service. So they would get utility breaks so they could go, they could run, they could get right of way, they could do all that, they would get tax credits. New Jersey ended up paying Verizon, you know, billions of dollars. So they run fiber everywhere. Then they provided service to no one. This is true. Like, almost no one in New Jersey has Fios, even though Verizon got all this money and all this access and this state-sponsored monopoly. No one in New Jersey got Fios. And then after they've used Title II to run the fiber, they're saying, well, broadband itself, which runs over the fiber, is an information service. So we want to chuck Title II. And they literally, their lawyers go back and forth between the sections of the law that they most appeal to them for each service they provide, even though it's all running over the same cable. And I think that's sort of just where we've landed, right? They're, even when they do invest and they do lay the cable on the ground, which is the first step, companies like Verizon, companies like Comcast are consistently manipulating the law that we have because it isn't clear enough and it doesn't provide strident enough controls on what are monopolies, either natural or given to them by the state. And I think that's just the problem. So going to Title II, yeah, maybe it'll make their investment fall, but I think the reality is when they're held to a standard, when they have to provide services to people and they have to spend money because we're demanding it as a society, they will find ways to make that investment profitable. I do not have an ounce of worry in my heart that Comcast can't figure out how to make money and that Verizon can't figure out how to make money. That doesn't keep me up at night. What keeps me up at night is huge sections of our population that don't have access to reasonable broadband.
All right. Well, I'm told that our second guest for our net neutrality discussion is available and can join us. That's Baron Soka. If you watch the show, you've seen Baron on the show before. He's been on several times. He's with techfreedom.org. Hello, Baron.
Hi. Sorry about the confusion.
Oh, no problem. We're just so glad you could join us today. Obviously, yesterday was a very big day. Neil and I were saying earlier that, you know, seldom have we watched C-SPAN with such rapt attention. Huh. And there was quite a big hearing at the FCC yesterday on the issue of net neutrality, statements by all of the commissioners and the chairman, and now 200 pages of documents to digest and comment upon until September, when in all likelihood, some iteration of the open internet rules that were proposed yesterday will be adopted. So I led off with Neil by asking him what his highlight from the hearing was. Why don't I ask you the same?
Yeah, it's a hoax. You heard it yesterday. You heard it from Eli today. Number one, there is no demonstrated problem here that can't be addressed through enforcement of existing laws, the antitrust laws and the consumer protection laws. Number two, the FCC is rushing into this when members on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, called on the agency not to rush. The agency should be doing a more careful job of actually thinking through, looking before it's leaping. And third, so there's the hoax that there's a problem here and that the FCC urgently has to act. And then there's the Title II hoax. So let me lay this out for you in a as simple as I can. So the people who were literally jumping up and screaming yesterday during the meeting about Title II have no idea what Title II actually means. They think that Title II will end fast lanes, will prohibit prioritization on the internet. That is not true. All Title II means is that the FCC would have more power to regulate prioritization. So without Title II, they can regulate it, but they can't require that every broadband company provide exactly the same service to everybody. There has to be some room for what the DC Circuit called individualized negotiation. Whereas under Title II, the way that prioritization works and always has worked is you can prioritize, you can have fast lanes if you want to, but you have to go through what was called tariffing, where you file with the government the schedule of rates that you're going to charge to differently situated customers. So it's just not true that Title II is some radical difference that's going to allow the FCC to prohibit prioritization. Prioritization is always been part of the internet. It's the very thing that makes Google and Facebook and other services work. The question here has never been about net neutrality. The question has always been about whether broadband providers might be in a position to abuse market power in discriminating against certain providers. And as I said, the antitrust laws already deal with that. If you think that that's not enough, the FCC can deal with that through Section 706. So the real question becomes, does the FCC reclassify broadband, or I should say classify for the first time, broadband as a Title II carrier? And the argument for that basically is the reasonable people will say, okay, we recognize that there are some problems with Title II. And so we're just going to forbear carefully, and we'll edit Title II down to basically a new framework for regulating broadband. That's what Jenikowski proposed back in 2010 when the FCC tried to do this the first time. And if you remember anything that I had to tell you today, that is complete horseshit. That is not how reclassification or forbearance works. And the explanation is very simple. Forbearance is a difficult and cumbersome process. So the FCC has to justify why it's not applying certain rules and why it is applying others. And it would also have to justify not just going easy on broadband because we're concerned about broadband investment, it would also have to justify why it's not treating similar internet services the same way. Because legally, what we're talking about here is internet transmission services, and Google and other services, I don't want them to be more regulated. But as a legal matter, once you start going into Title II, the FCC then has to go through a very complicated series of legal contortions to explain either why some things, like broadband, should be under Title II and other things shouldn't, or why, if it's all going to be under Title II, why the FCC is going to forbear from some things, from some provisions of Title II and not from others. So the bottom line is that in order to get a relatively small difference of how far the FCC can go in regulating discrimination, the FCC would have to completely change the presumption of regulation that was put in place not by the Bush administration, but by Bill Clinton's FCC. And it was that decision to put broadband under Title I that unleashed $1.2 trillion of private investment that built today's broadband networks. So that's what we're talking about here today. And that's why I say this is a hoax. And the FCC, because of this political hoax, because people have been conned into thinking that Title II means something other than it does and that it would be easy to apply, the FCC is now going through this farce where they have to pretend that Title II is a realistic option and that they're considering it before doing what every serious person knows they're going to do in the end anyway, which is to try to regulate through Section 706.
Right. And do you think that they'll still have problems if we take everything you just said as a given under 706? Do you think once again the DC Circuit or another court will come in and say, once again, FCC, this you've done, gone too far here?
Well, there's two different potential risks. There's three issues with titles with 706. Number one is the fight here is really about the outer boundary on 706, which is they can't impose common carriage. And common carriage, as I was saying about Title II, would mean saying something like, okay, if you're going to prioritize, you have to charge exactly the same price to all similarly situated services. That would be a common carriage requirement. And the FCC probably can't do that through 706. Now, they can do things like saying, if you favor an affiliate, or you in some other fashion discriminate, that could be a violation under 706. So that's one legal issue. Second issue down the road is, and frankly, this is true whether they use 706 here or not, and it's true whether they reclassify or not. 706 allows the FCC, as they have interpreted it, to regulate not just broadband, but the entire internet. In fact, all communications, which is very disturbing. And that brings me to the third point, which is I have to say, while I think that it's possible for the FCC to craft a relatively reasonable rule through 706, I also think that the FCC and the D.C. Circuit got it wrong, that 706 simply is not an independent grant of authority. And without unpacking that fully, I'll just say that the only reason that we're even there is because courts in general defer to agencies when a statute is ambiguous. And I think the legal error that the D.C. Circuit made was in determining that either that this statute is ambiguous or that the FCC's interpretation of it was reasonable. So it's possible that the courts will ultimately strike down anything the FCC does under 706. It's possible they'll reverse this interpretation. And I think that would, on the whole, be a good thing for the internet. It's probably not very likely. But this is my way of saying that the FCC really has no good options, legally speaking. What they really should be doing, what I would do if I were the chairman, is to say to Congress, 706 is shaky, and Title II is not a workable option. And rather than continue to try to do this for the third time and spend another 3 or 4 years going down a road that's probably going to lead to nowhere, the FCC, call on Congress to do what everybody across the political spectrum knows needs to be done, which is to update the Communications Act. Because the fundamental problem is that these titles, Title I, Title II, they don't correspond to the real world anymore. So there is, I think, a need for a new Communications Act. And this is not crazy. Verizon and Google in 2010 agreed on a joint legislative framework for a new Communications Act that would have solved this problem of how the FCC should regulate net neutrality. And in 2005, you had a broad bipartisan group of telecom experts that proposed what was called the Digital Age Communications Act to fix this general problem, rewrite the act, and give the FCC a sensible way of regulating broadband and the internet generally without subjecting Google and Facebook and all the other companies that the FCC claims to be trying to protect here to the kind of regulatory burdens that the FCC might be able to impose through 706 and might be forced to subject to Title II in court, even if they don't want to. So anyway, I just want this to be ultimately left up to the democratic decision-making process. It's a policy question, and it's not one that the FCC really has the tools or the competence to be trying to solve.
But the people are speaking, yeah. Right? I mean, they might be conned. You might think they're low information voters in a sense, right? They're speaking. They're saying they desperately want broadband to be regulated as a utility, as a common carrier. And whether or not you agree with what they're saying, the substance of what they're saying, they're definitely saying it. They're saying it more loudly and more vigorously about telecom policy than just about anything else. It's actually remarkable.
So, yeah. Well, you know, Nalay, the last time I checked, we don't live in a mobocracy. We have elected representatives who are sent to Congress who are supposed to make decisions.
But they're
so when I say
too.
Democratic, listen to me.
People
don't get to scream
too,
and bang. No. Congress ultimately can make this decision.
Are you
and
saying
they
that the people of the United States of America, instead of speaking however they wish to speak, they should quietly petition their elected representatives who then make a decision in their best interests? That sounds crazy to me.
So this is hilarious because you're trying to embrace democratic legitimacy, but what you're really saying is you want three unelected bureaucrats at the FCC to decide what they think the people
want. To use
want,
authority that they already have.
Instead of having our elected representatives decide what is actually going to be the law.
That docket is open. The path is clear, right? You can walk right through that door and you and I can argue about the substance of Title II, but the demand from the public for the FCC to more legitimately consider that is clearly there. And there's no reason of process.
It's based on misrepresentations
how is it manufactured?
Like you of what this issue is about.
Wait, how am I manufacturing this issue?
What exactly is the harm here? The FCC has alleged four instances over 15 years of supposed net neutrality violations, two of which wouldn't even be dealt with by their proposed rules. This is a hoax. The FCC has never demonstrated
that there's a problem. Wait, I can tell you the harm is very clear.
You have also misrepresented it, as has everybody else, what Title II actually means and whether the FCC can actually apply it in any sensible way.
Title II is a politically realistic option.
And even the Democrats on the commission who have pushed for the FCC to ask about Title II, I don't think are serious about actually using it.
So what your argument boils down to is you don't believe the Democrats are serious about the option they're proposing. That's silly. What you're actually saying is the harms aren't there and we should wait for the harms to accrue before we do anything about them. And I've been covering this industry deeply for years, ever since, broadband became the force for change in this country. And I'm telling you, I see the harms at every turn because these companies are not in a competitive market, and they do not have incentives to act in a rational way that serves the interest of the consumer.
So I'm telling you, as a telecom lawyer, which you are not, that Title II, A, doesn't do what you think it does, and B, cannot be applied effectively because forbearance is not a realistic option.
So let me ask you a question. Why did the FCC originally try to apply Title II with forbearance?
To get government out of the way of broadband deployment. I would point out to you that while you and others talk about cable being a monopoly, in fact, cable is losing ground to telco providers today who have turned DSL into what was once a joke and a slow option into something that at speeds of like 45 megabits per second is actually faster than cable. So A, there in fact is competition coming from telephone companies.
Okay, who is my competition? I live in New York City and I have Time Warner Cable. Who am I going to because that service
So AT&T by the end of 2015 has said that they will deploy 45 megabit per second
I'm waiting a year and a half for AT&T's promise infrastructure deployment. That's your competition.
So let's, for example, look at Verizon. Why do you think it was that Verizon didn't deploy in major cities like Baltimore and Boston? It wasn't because they didn't want to. It was because those cities made it prohibitively difficult to deploy new infrastructure, which is precisely the same experience that Google Fiber has had. They have tried to deploy, and they found that local governments have made that unnecessarily difficult. So I'm all in favor of more broadband competition. We could actually be having that discussion, and that would be productive. Instead, we keep running around and around pretending that the FCC can solve a problem that hasn't been demonstrated.
Let me ask you a question, though.
I need to jump in for just a second here. I want to just interject that as I listen to you both, I'm coming to the opinion that perhaps you're both right, and that it's always been my inclination looking at this issue that we're only having this conversation because of the confusion, the legislative confusion about what fits into Title I and what fits into Title II, and the internet not fitting properly into either, and that Congress really needs to fix that. And the way we fix that is amending the Telecommunications Act. But Neeli and I were talking about this at the top of the show, Baron, that, you know, until that can happen, that might be a slow process. Hasn't happened yet. Congress certainly doesn't seem to be in a rush, even though, you know, as we sit here today, the urgent need for that has never been more clear, that the FCC does have some room to work here and that they may as well give it a shot. And that, you know, I understand, Baron, that your position is giving it a shot is going to mess things up more than help. But if the FCC agrees, disagrees, there's no reason why they can't, you know, continue down this road and then let Congress correct them, right?
Well, one, there is no demonstrated problem. Two, the problem with the FCC persisting in this area at all is that it delays a political solution. The thing that has prevented Congress more than anything else from dealing with this problem is that the FCC keeps saying, oh, no, we'll figure out another way to deal with the issue, which they can't. And third, if you thought there was a problem today, let's just suppose that's true. The thing that has never been tried is the very thing that the White House has said in general is the best way to solve internet governance problems, which is convene a multi-stakeholder process, get industry together with consumer advocates, the same way that Google and Verizon were able to sit down together, have them come up with the code of conduct.
Google and Verizon entered into a marriage of absolute convenience to ship Android on Verizon.
That code of conduct, if it could be generated, and maybe it can't, but we won't know until we try, would be directly enforceable today, not by the FCC, but by the Federal Trade Commission. You would need to demonstrate no abuse of market power. There would be no need to go through any complicated antitrust system. It would be directly enforceable There would be no legal challenge involved. I think that's a process that's worth trying. And frankly, if we had tried that, if we had said 10 years ago that we're going to try that approach and we're going to focus on promoting broadband deployment, I think we would have solved this problem the same way that we solve other problems in the internet ecosystem, which is from the bottom up instead of expecting the FCC to solve them from the top down.
Look, here's the thing about invoking Google and Verizon, which completely ignores as a model, invoking Google and Verizon as a model for industry collaboration to receive a good result. Google and Verizon entered into a marriage of absolute political convenience. Google wanted to ship Android as a competitor to the iPhone on Verizon first before Apple. They backed off extremely strident net neutrality demands to gain the concession from Verizon. And several years later, Verizon totally screwed Google and knifed Google Wallet, refused to update the software on their phones they're shipping on Verizon. And that marriage is irretrievably broken. If you just ask anybody who works at Google or Verizon, they will tell you that that didn't work out very well because the leverage shifted in the market to the carriers. And if you look at what happens over and over again.
With the fact that their policy teams were able to hammer out a joint legislative framework for dealing with net neutrality. Nothing. The point is that there is, in fact, a reasonable common ground.
That framework was Verizon's framework that Google gave up on.
And I will point you to back in 2005, the Digital Age Communications Act project was mostly composed of Democrat academics. It was able to come to a consensus with free market academics on how to reform the FCC.
Look, if you and I sat down in a vacuum today and said, let's rewrite a new telecom law, I guarantee you that you and I could just do it. Right? That's great. That's a vacuum. That's la-la land. What's actually happening is the market is shifting rapidly.
No, what's actually la-la land is thinking that the FCC can continue to apply a Communications Act that was written before 1996 that was based on the assumptions of the monopoly telephone era and can be trusted to apply that system to the internet. Because what that actually means is that the FCC will end up regulating internet services.
We used to ship the internet over phone lines, right? I mean, you used to get dial-up. The prices were low. There were many competitors. You could do all kinds of things. Many businesses emerged running, you know, modems over phone lines. What is the specific difference between a cable that brings, and I'm stupid and I don't have a preconceived answer to this question, but what is the difference between that service and the service that brought voice telecommunications into my home? Why are you so convinced that there's a difference in the nature of that utility to consumer?
Bill Kennard, who was Bill Clinton's FCC chairman, made this decision. Back in 1998, he rightly recognized that the massive infrastructure investment, which, as I said, has been $1.2 trillion since then, that to get that massive infrastructure investment, you could not continue to apply the regulations of Title II. He was right. That has been a bipartisan approach that has been completely sensible.
If I'm a consumer, tell me exactly why these services are different, that why broadband shouldn't be treated as utility, because the experience is the same, and it should be the same. Right? I can call whoever I want on the phone service. I should be able to go to whatever service I want to on broadband. And you're making an argument, as near as I can tell, your argument is this is too messy and the government sucks, right? Which I agree with you. This is messy and the government sucks. But the government has to act here because the nature of this utility is too important to leave alone, to leave unregulated. And the market, whether or not you agree with me, the market is not competitive. It absolutely is not competitive.
The market could be more competitive. There's plenty we could do. The FCC, among other things, could have been spending the last few years on, for example, opening up spectrum or making it easier to build towers.
The thing they did after the net neutrality debate yesterday was talk about the incentive auction.
Yeah, they were supposed to have opened up 500 megahertz of spectrum by now. They have opened up zero. They are years behind in that because they have spent that time fighting about net neutrality. There is a real cost to the FCC in falling behind on those priorities when it gets focused on something like net neutrality.
It hasn't been focused on that. Until the 2010 decision was struck down 3 months ago, it hasn't been focused on neutrality.
The FCC spent the better part of 2 years on the net neutrality issue.
Okay, so what was it doing from 2010 until a few months ago? Just sitting around not planning the incentive auction?
Well, for one, Janikowski squandered the room for goodwill, had the opportunity to work together with Republicans and his relationships on the Hill on this issue. But
because
let me get back to
Julius Janikowski. He wasn't well known for being like the ultimate nice guy politician. I mean, your argument, yeah, he wasted his time. He wasn't a good agency head, and you know he was mean to the Republicans. So for 2 years, he sat on his hands. And the incentive auction, which is happening,
this is a distraction. Your fundamental point is so other legal academics, for example, have said, "Hey, well, this looks like a telecommunications service, so it should be." My point at the end of the day is that is the law professor's delusion. It doesn't really matter how you parse the legal definitions, because frankly, those were developed in an era that does not remotely resemble the world of today. What matters today is what is the right legal framework for governing broadband? And one part of that is indeed how you deal with the potential for discrimination. I completely agree with you. The other part of that is, at the end of the day, do we make consumers better off? And a big part of that is, are people going to continue investing at the scale that they have been in infrastructure? And so what I'm really saying fundamentally is that Title II is a system that was developed for monopoly pricing. Right? That's what a utility was. That's what AT&T was. We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a world where there are at least two options. Telco's getting better. And you're starting to see a third pipe like Google Fiber or CenturyLink or Sonic.net.
That's insane.
Deployed.
Okay, Google Fiber is not in these
Let
cities.
Let me finish.
Okay.
You're starting to see
Go
that
ahead.
Pipe deployed. And the question is, do you want that pipe to exist at all? Because in a Title II world, why would any sane company ever pour money into being treated like a utility, which means that they would be forced to open up their utility, their network, and allow other companies to resell it?
So there's your answer,
Clinton,
right?
Clinton
no,
FCC.
But that's your answer. No, that's literally the thing you just said is the answer to the question. The sane companies shouldn't be dumping money into trying to build a competitive market for services that are overpriced and badly received by consumers. Those services, Comcast, which is huge and a behemoth in providing service, is already providing the utility service. We just have to wake up and say what it is. And the money that you're talking about should go towards new businesses
and new
services on that market.
So you have admitted what the left is very reluctant generally to admit, which is that you don't actually want competition. You want to nationalize or essentially treat as a public utility a single network. You don't really want there to be more deployment because you just want to have, let's have Comcast be the network. We'll treat it as a public utility and done. What I'm saying is competition has already happened. Verizon has poured billions of dollars into building out Fios, would have built it out more if they could have. AT&T and other telco companies are pouring money into upgrading their own networks. And Google Fiber is, in fact, deploying in more cities. Facilities-based competition is real. It's happening. We should encourage it. Title II would be a death knell for all of that.
Just the fact that you pronounce it Fios is indicative of your relative knowledge on what is actually happening in this market, right? Fios is great. It's just not anywhere, right? It literally is tiny, right?
So if you want to get – okay. So hold on a second.
Google Fiber is wonderful.
Excuse me.
And
70% of Verizon's footprint will see fiber deployment by the end of next year.
Sure.
Right, is what
and
I
all
told.
Of New Jersey will get Fios by tomorrow, right? It's not happening. These companies have no incentive to actually do it because they can extract more revenue from their existing investment.
Let's pretend for just a second that you're right. Then the question is, does Title II actually help or hurt that situation? And at the end of the day, you continue to persist in believing that somehow Title II will not have a negative effect on investment, which at the end of the day means less
investment
competition.
Where? If Title II does nothing but provide a minimum level of service to people and pushes investment dollars into new business and entrepreneurship, I am totally okay with that. Because I don't want to see Google blowing billions on building a fiber network to compete with with fiber networks that aren't doing a good enough job. That's silly.
Okay, guys, we're not going to solve the Title I, Title II issue here. Okay. And maybe Congress is going to solve it at some point, but this has been a very rousing and interesting discussion, but I would like to shift gears for a second back to what Barron would characterize as the hoax, the fact that people have begun to think that there is some danger to the internet service that they expect and want and demand on a consumer level. At the beginning of the hearing yesterday, Mignon Clyburn, the commissioner, said open internet can't occur organically. That's why we're acting, because in her estimation, this is not something that you can just leave to the market and expect to function. And there's been a little video going around that attempts to explain the problem in lay terms and with graphics by Vihart. And there's a segment of it I'd like to play here because I think it...
So instead of fixing it, Comcast charges you even more and still doesn't fix it. Here's the officially proposed rule the FCC is considering. Internet service providers must offer some amount of access to all legal internet things, but they can offer a fast lane to certain content providers. This sounds like maybe Comcast and Netflix collaborate to put in a special cable all the way from Netflix right to your home to get super fast Netflix service. But that's not what this fast lane is. It's not even a nice new paved driveway. The fast lane means that Comcast puts a gate in front of your driveway. The Netflix trucks are allowed in right away because they paid off the gatekeeper. You invite your friend over, and your friend has to wait outside the gate for a while, even when no one else is using your driveway. If you want to watch Netflix right now, yes, you should be able to prioritize Netflix's data and slow everything else down. But if after that you want to torrent the latest Vihart video, there's no technical reason you shouldn't be able to put that in the fast lane. You're not paying your ISP for content, you're paying them to deliver the content you choose. Except they decided maybe they do want to control what content you can choose, and the FCC's proposed rule would make that officially okay, which is a huge reversal of the FCC's position that happened when Tom Wheeler, a formal cable lobbyist, became chairman. In 2004, the FCC basically said, hey,
okay,
ISPs,
we can
need some network neutrality rules for you.
Let Vi go. All right, the gate idea is what I wanted to focus in on there. I think that's what has people up in arms here. That once you're paying for some level of access, it should apply across the board. The ISPs should not be able to decide what you're going to receive at one speed versus another. And that if we believe Commissioner Clyburn, that's not going to happen organically on its own. Barron, can you respond to that?
Yeah, that entire video is a calculated misrepresentation of the facts and the law. It is part of the ongoing hoax here that I referred to. The fact is that A, under Title II, there will still be prioritization. There has always been prioritization. That's what internet service companies do today. So the video is conflating two very different issues in such a way as to get people riled up the way that they have been. They're playing on fears about blocking, right? Which is, you know, the cable company is going to decide that you don't get to see certain content. Right, which is something that nobody wants to see happen. I don't think is very likely to happen. There's no evidence that it would, but I'd be fine with the rule that says no blocking. And that's the kind of thing that both the FCC could do under Section 706 and that there is clear demonstrated political consensus to do legislatively. But that's not what we're talking about. What we're really talking about is that the FCC is being pushed to ban all prioritization, which has never been the case on the internet, has never been allowed under Title II. And people like the people who produced that video and the supposed journalists who are writing about this but who are in fact editorializing have conned people into thinking that that is actually what we're talking about.
I mean, really
what
you're saying is that
the FCC actually doing that.
I mean, that's what I'm hearing from you. They're not good enough lawyers. You're the best lawyer, and all the people on the internet who are worried about real things that are happening to them, their lawyering isn't good enough, so we should dismiss them. But what they're actually saying is, this is important to us. It's important for these ways, and the FCC should use whatever authority it has to solve our problems. That's what they're demanding. And what you're saying is you need to jump through whatever
it is. They have been conned into thinking
that
the left's delusion. This is exactly like the right being conned into thinking that the Obama administration was going to run death panels. They're both delusions by people in positions of authority in the media who have a political incentive to get their base stoked up.
You're saying when Jenikowski proposed his initial third way plan using Title II and forbearance, he was under some delusion. He was crazy, and that the plan that his telecom lawyers, you know, maybe I'm a different kind of lawyer, I'm not a fancy telecom lawyer like you, but his telecom lawyers, they blew it too. That's your position?
Austin Schlick, fundamentally, the entire argument for Title II Lite, what he proposed early in 2010, which was opposed by 74 House Democrats. The entire argument hinged on the idea that forbearance allows the FCC to
What I remember,
just let like me to edit down Title II into a simple set of reasonable rules. And as I've tried to explain to you before, while it might be true that there is room for a consensus about some set of those rules, the FCC does not have a workable process for creating that consensus. That's something that only Congress can do, or the FCC can try to do to a limited extent through Section 706, although at the end of the day, I have to say again that the courts, I think, will ultimately decide that 706 is not an independent grant of authority, which is just another reason why the FCC should leave this matter to Congress.
I mean, your argument continues to boil down to there are too many hoops to jump through. But what I'm suggesting to you is that what happened with the original third-way proposal was that the right started screaming that the FCC was going to, quote, regulate the internet, riled up public opinion about regulating the internet, which was inaccurate at that time as well. And we ended up with this the mess of the 2010 rules.
Yeah, so, which is why those 74 House Democrats opposed the even Title II light, right? Because they were conned into doing that by the right, because they were just lunatic conservatives. In fact, those House Democrats, excuse me, understood what Bill Kennard, Bill Clinton's FCC chairman, understood back in the late 90s, which was that Title II would be fatal to broadband investment and the overall health of the ecosystem, and importantly, would in fact bring the FCC into regulating the very edge companies that it says it's trying to protect. They understood that. Bill Clinton's FCC understood that.
Wait, so how did Title II not – I mean, how do we not end up regulating AOL dial-up under Title II when we were running it over the phone lines? I mean, that seems to be your point, is that if we impose Title II on broadband, we'll end up by accident somehow regulating Google because it'll provide service, internet services over broadband. But that didn't happen in the dial-up era. We didn't regulate what was happening on AOL. And in fact – the reason that AOL was – those companies were able to start saying broadband is an information service is they started pointing to all the services they were offering over Title II telephone services and saying, but this is what we really do, right? What we're really doing is building a combined service of an access layer and an information layer, and you should not touch that because it's different than the phone service that we're actually using right now. So how did we end up fixing that problem under Title II and avoiding it then, but now we're just going to rush into it blindly because our lawyers aren't good enough?
But Neelai, I'm reminded of what you said at the top of the show about how we have to be careful to have laws that make sense no matter who's applying them. So, you know, we might have had good luck in applying Title II in the past, but if it's ambiguous and you know, is broad enough to encompass some nefarious kinds of results that we don't want to see happen, then that needs to be fixed.
Well, no, I agree, but I'm asking a simple question. If it is a one-to-one, if it's, you know, the consequence is clear of imposition of Title II, you end up regulating edge companies, why didn't it happen before?
Look, it's not clear. Look, my point at the end of the day
but you,
is
but
not –
but you've been saying to me over and over again that it is clear.
Let me make this as clear as I can. The arguments for Title II are essentially that the FCC will just say, oh, Title II, we'll forbear, or we're done. What will actually happen is that the FCC will spend years, first in its own proceedings, probably in a series of proceedings, going back and forth about exactly how to do, first of all, reclassification and why it should reclassify some internet transmission services, broadband, but not other internet transmission services like voice communications and text messaging and services like Google. Google search, for example, right? And exactly what those legal differences are. They will have to defend all of that in litigation. That will go through several rounds. They will also have to defend every single one of the forbearance decisions they make under every single one of the 48 sections that comprise Title II. So at the end of the day, the simplest way I can put this is I don't know what the outcome of that whole process would be. I can't tell you exactly what would and wouldn't be regulated, but I can tell you that it would take years, and it would introduce great uncertainty into the ecosystem, which would harm broadband investment, competitive deployment, new entrants like Google Fiber, and yes, indeed, may subject some internet services, some internet transmission services to Title II regulation. And so the question today is, do we want to go through that nightmare, or do we, as Bill Clinton's FCC chairman decided in the late 90s, do we avoid going down that road and instead find an alternative path? And I would prefer that alternative path be new legislation, but I've given you two other options. 706 would be a better option, and also today, which would require no legislation, would be at least trying a multi-stakeholder process.
I mean,
okay.
I think is the question, right? Why are those nightmares of a lesser? I mean, all of that, all of it, right, is an endless series of litigation and lawyering. And what you're saying is we should do the slower ones because the faster one seems like more litigation and lawyering. But what
so
you're
in
never-
1996, the Telecommunications Act set up an elaborate regime for saying that, okay, there isn't enough competition for telephone services, so we're going to mandate unbundling so that resellers can come in, artificially created so-called competitive resellers, and sell that component. The FCC spent 8 years trying to figure out how to apply that regime. And what I'm saying is that that's exactly the kind of mess that you would see come out of the Title II process. And what would you get out of it? In that case, by the time the FCC had actually figured that out, the market had changed such that today the telephone market is incredibly competitive. A third of consumers get their telephone service from their cable company. A third have switched entirely to getting it from their wireless company. So facilities-based competition actually has worked there. And it can work here. We should be talking about the thing that you and I agree on, which is making it easier to deploy competitive networks.
And we certainly do agree there. I mean, I just don't – I do not see – and you might characterize what I'm saying as nationalizing broadband, which I think is a laughable characterization. But sure, I'll take the name. But what I see is a behemoth, a burgeoning behemoth that wants to get bigger, that is vertically integrating, and that is setting a model for many, many other broadband companies who are providing a difficult to switch from utility to American consumers. And that switching cost is so high, you don't see it right now, but it's so high that other competitors that come in are going to make it difficult, right? There's no wireless broadband is great, and people are switching to it, and some people use it as a primary, but it is so much more expensive. And those companies are colluding to make sure that you're buying a bundle of services instead of true competition where you would move to a different access layer. And I don't think that the market is going to change so substantially that Comcast will find itself with its pants down the way that the voice providers did, the telcos did.
All right. You know, guys, one of the most common questions we have gotten for people writing into the show on the various net neutrality discussions that we've had is, could we have some explanation of Title I, Title II, and the relative pros and cons of each approach? And I think this show has been a wonderful explication, or at least a good roadmap to the difficulties of the issue. So I really want to thank you guys for hashing through this. I know that we could go on and on with it, but I do want to shift gears. And Neelai, we're going to go ahead and let you go. So that we can bring on a couple of guests to talk about some privacy-related things that happened this week, the decision of the Court of Justice of the EU relating to the right to be forgotten. But we're not going to forget this show anytime soon, and I'm not going to forget how grateful I am that you were able to join us today, Neelai.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. And Baron, I enjoyed the conversation as heated as it might have become. It was a good one.
Yeah, me too. No, Baron's still here, I think. Baron, you're still here, right?
Well, I have to say I don't enjoy this conversation. Yep. I would rather have a conversation about how to promote broadband deployment and how to actually write a new telecom act that makes sense in the real world. I'm tired, as you can probably tell, of talking about imaginary problems and imaginary legal authority for the FCC to solve them.
Yeah, no, you're a great guy. I got
to
go.
Neelai, we'll talk to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye. And Baron, why don't I ask you to finish out your thought there, echoing Commissioners Pay and O'Reilly, that this is a misstep at this point, and that the, speaking of forbearance, the FCC would have been wise to forbear here and wait for Congress to step in and give clarification. Title II, we've been talking about, was going to be politically difficult on a number of fronts. Do you think that if the FCC hadn't jumped into the breach and proposed new open internet rules, it would have been politically difficult in other ways?
Well, sure. But what I'm saying here is that Title II is a crazy option. And anybody who understands the downsides of Title II and the difficulty of forbearance, I don't see how they can take it seriously. So the question, I mean, it's pretty clear that the chairman has been trying to push through what I think are relatively reasonable, although set of rules, although not ones that I would ultimately support, but relatively reasonable set of rules under Section 706. And my basic point is that he has been pushed into having to go through this farce of considering Title II because of the mob mentality, the hysteria around this that's been drummed up by activist groups like Free Press and some very shoddy journalism in this area. And so I understand why he's doing what he's doing, but I'm my prediction descriptively is that the FCC will do what it was going to do anyway, which is to propose rules that looked very much like the original rules under Section 706. And the people who've been screaming about net neutrality will continue to use this as an issue to raise money and be politically active and get people riled up about internet policy when it was never a realistic option in the first place. But the rules that the FCC proposes will be ample to deal with whatever conjectural problem there actually is. It's just that I would prefer, I think it's better for everybody, that this issue be left to Congress so that the FCC actually has a workable legal toolkit for addressing not only this problem, but other consumer protection and competition issues raised on the internet. And that's really only going to come either through a shift to multi-stakeholder processes or through writing a new Communications Act.
Right.
Let me just give just one more point, Denise, on your point about Title I and Title II. The thing people don't really understand is that the Communications Act has silos. Cable is Title VI. Wireless services are Title III. Title II is for common carriers like traditional telephony. And then Title I is everything else. It's the internet and information services. And the FCC has limited ability to regulate those by design. And so what we're really debating, what this really comes down to, is that there's a movement for the FCC to do something like a Title 1.5, something in the middle. Right. And what I'm trying to say is that you can't trust the FCC to do that by then switching the presumption to Title II and then trying to crawl back from that through forbearance. And that 706 has its own set of problems, including the fact that 706 lets the FCC regulate the entire internet in any way that they think will promote broadband competition, which could include cybersecurity or copyright or decency or who knows what else. So the only way to deal with these problems is new legislation. And the worst thing about the FCC persisting and trying to act here is that it saps the political will for compromise, because no one on the Hill will ever, ever write legislation until the agency goes to them and says, you must act. That is the only thing that will get us a new act.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like they're rushing into the breach that seems to exist without an affirmative request from the agency. Well, I think, you know, the discussion today has been really good and back and forth and informative and heated. And I know people have been out there munching away on something while we've been going at it. If you haven't been, now would be a good time to think about taking a break because we have a sponsor for this show that I have not yet had the chance to thank. And I'm going to do that right now. And that is NatureBox. And if you're out there eating something greasy or awful, I'm really happy to be able to point you to this company because it's a far better choice for your munching away opportunities during TWIT because you want to be eating right when you're starving or cranky or all hopped up over the politics on your favorite show about technology law. Stay away from those evil vending machines or the other kind of junk that you might have laying around. And you want to check out instead naturebox.com/twit because when you do that, you'll get three different subscription options for some really healthy and delicious choices. You've got three options. You can choose any one of them. And then you select what snacks you want to come each month. And you can fine tune this very nicely. They're vegan, soy-free, gluten-conscious, lactose-free, nut-free, and non-GMO options available. You can select by the kind of taste that you like. I'm a savory person, but you might like sweet or spicy a little bit better. NatureBox then sends great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the United States. We're talking healthy and satisfying snacks like banana bread granola, peppery pistachios, and over 100 more, all with zero trans fat, zero high fructose corn syrup, and nothing artificial. NatureBox is the snack happy gift that keeps on giving. Order a 3, 6, or 12-month subscription for that special someone, family, or friend. And don't forget swimsuit weather's almost here. Believe me, here in Southern California, it has arrived big time. So you want to snack smarter. Forget that vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like South Pacific plantains. So remember, to get 50% off of your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong. Go to naturebox.com/twit. Thank you so much, NatureBox, for your support of This Week in Law. All right. Well, I'm not sure if Mark Paulding had to finally run because we were keeping him a little bit over the time we had anticipated getting him on the show. But we're going to soldier on without him. Hopefully we can get him on at some point to discuss the privacy stories that we saved for the end here. And the really big one I'm sure folks have been reading about is that the Court of Justice of the European Union, which is the European Union's high court, issued a decision on a case that's been rattling around in the EU for some time, which had to do with a gentleman who did not like the fact that you could find information about the fact, I think his home had been foreclosed on, online. And he's been suing about this. It's been working its way up the courts, and the High Court of the EU has now decided that he and others like him have the opportunity to go to Google and other search engines and have that kind of information removed. Now, the logistics of this have yet to pan out, and we're very fortunate that we have Maria Murphy, who is a privacy professor at Maynooth in Ireland. Hello, Maria.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going really well. I'm good. So glad you could join us today. I'm sure you've been paying a lot of attention to this decision. Why don't you see if you can put it in context for us and give us how you think it's going to play out?
Well, the context is that the right to be forgotten is a right that's getting a lot of attention in recent years, that part of the new proposed amended regulation that's going through the procedures being worked through the legislative houses in the EU at the moment, that one major element of it was that this right to be forgotten was to be strengthened. So some people don't like the use of the term so much. It's really just a strengthening of traditional rights of erasure. So we don't have our new legislation yet. It's still being debated. It's being held up by the Council of Ministers. But what we do have is the old 1995 directive. So quite an elderly piece of law, really, governing such a modern area. And this is what we're dealing with at the moment. And that's what the court was using, along with the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union, which protects both a right to private life and a right to access to information. So as you said, we have this Spanish national who was unhappy with some articles that appeared as Google search results following a Google of his own name. So that's a crucial part of the decision, is the fact that it was the Googling of his name. So it's the connection between the personal information with his identity that is an important point. It's not necessarily some sort of broad scale censure of search engines in general. And crucially, it doesn't require the content itself be taken down. And I think that's something that changes the debate between whether this is a major conflict for freedom of expression, because the actual expressed content is still there. It's still accessible online, perhaps even by using Google, just using modified search terms.
So, for example, if I were searching for foreclosure in the town where this gentleman lived, as long as I was not searching on his name, I might well get the same article.
Exactly. So legitimate reasons for studying this issue would lead you to the correct article, the correct information, but perhaps a search on a job candidate or a date you're going on wouldn't bring up this potentially excessively prejudicial information.
And can you tell us, I'm sure you're understanding of how EU law and policy gets enacted is far superior to ours. We have this decision from the court now, but from the coverage I've seen, it's going to remain to the individual countries to decide what to do with it, how to enact it.
Well, the current governing legislation in data protection is the Data Protection Directive. And directives in EU law are where there's a general framework set out and certain goals to be achieved, but member states bring about the law, incorporate the law in their own way. But there are specific guidelines and certain elements that must be achieved in national law. So under the current situation, most states in Europe have their own data protection acts. And under these acts, everybody's obliged to establish their own data protection authority. So under the current rules, based on which member state you are national in, you obviously approach Google or Yahoo or Bing, ask them to take down the information that you believe is contrary to your rights. If they, after balancing the competing rights there, believe that, no, we're going to leave it up, it's important for freedom of expression, for access to information, then you can then go to your own national data protection authority. So here in Ireland, it would be the Data Protection Commissioner. And he then could investigate the situation and determine whether he or she believes that it is a disproportionate interference with your right to private life.
So, Baron, you've been watching this, as I have, from across the pond here unfold. We obviously have a very different approach here in the U.S., although we're starting to see that approach chipped away at least here in California, we have a law that will take force in 2015 that is an erasure law as applies to minors. So the states are at least starting to flirt with this kind of notion here. And I'm wondering what your take on that is.
So I think there are two big issues. One is erasure. And in the U.S., fundamentally, we have the First Amendment. So Google has First Amendment rights to run its search algorithm the way that they want. And they don't have to take stuff down. And that's because, second, in the United States, back in the late 90s, just to talk about the legacy of the Clinton administration, they got it right with a general hands-off-the-internet approach. And one part of that was what we were just discussing about how they regulated broadband and telecom. But the other part of it, most importantly, was saying that we were not going to so-called deputize intermediaries. So in copyright, we did do it. And the way that works is we have a notice and takedown system where Google, if they run a search engine or YouTube or whatever, if somebody alleges that there's infringing material on the search engine, they can send in a notice. And there's a counter notice system that, you know, provides a little bit of control, but not a lot. And the result is that a lot of material just ends up getting taken down. Now, the problem is, if you were to apply that kind of thing to privacy or defamation or any kind of user content, what is nominally a notice system, you know, please take down this content, becomes a system of censorship, because it becomes a system where it's just not implementable. So that if the intermediary, that company in the middle, gets a request that says either this is defamatory, please take it down, or this invades my privacy, please take it down, they're just going to take it down. They can't possibly do even the minimal level of control and evaluation that they're able to do with copyrighted material. And so what you end up doing in the name of privacy is creating a system where it's now very easy, or it could be, depending on how the implementation works, just to have material taken down that you don't like, that may not be about you. You could pretend to be somebody. And the practical challenge of having to deal with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of potential requests on a site like Google or Facebook or Twitter is such that either they're just going to take down content, or many smaller sites are just going to stop offering user forums where users can post content that someone might allege is defamatory or invasive of privacy, as in this case. So it's an implementation nightmare that fundamentally chips away at the basic hallmarks of free speech, and Europe's just got it wrong again.
Maria, can you tell us what the actual standard is? You know, you're someone in the EU and there's something that's coming up in search results about you. It could be a news article, as in this particular case. Maybe it's an unflattering picture. Is there any sort of standard, or can you request that anything be dissociated from search results relating to your name?
Now, there are some limitations, but again, I will concede there are clear difficulties of definition here, because what is, for example, irrelevant for one person may not be irrelevant to another. So the court lists some factors which are grounds to have your information or their search results potentially erased if the information is inaccurate, if it's irrelevant, excessive, or out of date. So I think part of that actually goes to your second point there. Well, I think there is implementation difficulties here, and we certainly will see increased costs for Google, whether they choose to implement a decision through technical means, through altering their algorithm, or simply the expenditure on greater manpower. We will see an increase in the level of costs here. But this is important to the decision that they place the importance of fundamentally protected rights above the business interests of companies. So on that, the second point regarding, I forget what it was again now. Can you remind me what the second point was again?
You mean my second example?
No, sorry.
I think she's asking about what in the United States is Section 230, which says that intermediaries don't have a legal obligation to be responsible for user content.
Right. So in United States, Maria, we have this rule that if you are operating a website and people are posting up things that may be defamatory, for example, there's a whole other regime that applies if you're posting up things that may involve intellectual property infringement. But in the realm of defamation, there's strong protection for sites that they are not liable. And that what that does is it fosters, you know, a good deal of open discussion. Sites can be fairly comfortable that if they're not exercising a lot of editorial control over the public discourse on their site, that they're not going to be held legally responsible if one user defames another, for example. So how do you think obviously in Europe, there are different laws that would apply, and maybe, I have no idea whether any kind of parallel exists in any of the European countries. But Barron's point that, you know, if you're going to have to just take stuff down all the time or disassociate things from search results, that maybe not having spirited debate and discussion would be the preference to a whole lot of red tape and infrastructure. Is that a concern for you?
So, of course, it's a concern, and it's something that you need to be mindful of. But the reality is, I'm a little bit dubious always of fears being expressed from industry concerning how this is going to destroy their business model at the expense of human rights of ordinary people. Because remember, this particular ruling aims to protect ordinary people, the kind of people who don't have constant search hits turning up for them that can hide maybe the embarrassing ones from years past. Those one or two mistakes they made in the past will remain at the top because that's the only internet presence they really have. In terms of the implementation by Google, there is some noise at the moment already about the fact that Google does actually have some contingency plans regarding takedown notices, I suppose along the lines of the copyright takedown notices. I would be somewhat suspicious that it's going to be as detrimental to the provision of information as has been made out. Of course, the search engines will argue that and they're perfectly entitled to, but at the same time, it's beneficial for them to include these types of results, to be able to engage in the debate. That is what keeps their business model viable. So as a result, I don't believe that it'll be a mere case of deleting anything somebody makes a complaint about. That if you set up a system where, for example, algorithms could have it automatically set so that if certain factors are reached with a particular article or website that someone requests to be taken down, then that can receive further review. For example, if a web page is only a year old, it'll be much more difficult to have it removed. If someone claims in their hand that it's defamatory, then that will get pushed to the front of the pile. Irrelevant, of course, is going to be a more difficult decision to make. But if it's someone in the political life or a celebrity, someone who the public have a legitimate interest in, then Google or Bing will be able to dismiss that a lot more quickly. And they benefit a lot from actually including stories covering these type of stories that are in the general public interest.
Does it seem strange that someone in the US could maybe be doing research on an individual in the EU and get a different set of search results than someone in France might get?
I think it seems strange because of what we've become used to, because the web is very globalized. And I've heard some comparisons between what might happen with the balkanization of the web along the lines of what we might have in China with censorship. And I just think that's, I think it's unfair, because what you're going to have is, when you are focusing on the little guy, on the average person who wants to remove, as you said, an embarrassing photo or a bankruptcy filing, they care about what the people around them think about it. They care a lot less about what someone in LA or Philadelphia thinks about that information. What matters to them is if the person they've met on an online dating site or the job interview they're going for has seen that information, and whether they will use it prejudicially against them.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, it's just so unlike what I'm used to that it's difficult for me to get my head around and think either would be workable for the search entities, or necessarily a good idea for news gathering entities. I mean, the notion of making publicly available information about someone less accessible is a difficult concept for me to get behind personally, I guess. But I sympathize with people who would like to be able to leave some things behind and move on, but I just, I guess the EU High Court sympathizes as well, but it seems to me in today's day and age, that's sort of a naive thing to hope for. Baron, any final thoughts on this?
Your skepticism, Denise, is well-founded. What we're really talking about here is censorship. And it might be, we can think of lots of examples of instances where this could be a good thing. And I have no doubt that the people who are pushing this are well-intentioned. And Maria is absolutely right. There are real people who have a hard time because they might have a unique name, like, for example, mine. Right? So I understand what we're talking about here. But I think we should all be deeply disturbed by the practical, first of all, so it's two things. It's the precedent that we're setting here, which is, it's okay to go back and airbrush history, which is what tyrants do, right? And I think this is really important. We're talking here right now in the United States about the open internet. And at the same time, the Europeans are saying, well, we just want the internet to be a little bit less open. We want it to be safer, more controlled, and we need to be able to edit things out, right? I mean, there's a strong parallel. And that parallel becomes even stronger when you actually look at the practical implementation of this. So what Maria is really she talks about the bottom line of companies. Look, who cares about the bottom line of companies? That Google's not concerned about this because it's going to cost them money. If anything, Google is better positioned than anybody else to deal with this kind of regulatory burden, because they can have complicated systems. Like on YouTube, they have a system called Content ID that does algorithmic filtering, and that is somewhat effective. But what's really going to suffer is the other companies, smaller companies that can't possibly comply with the burden in any meaningful way. And again, they're either going to take down content willy-nilly, or they're not going to offer the robust social networking functionality that exists. So, and finally, just one ironic thing I would point out is that this is also going to further drive bright European entrepreneurs to Silicon Valley. You go out to San Francisco and you hear French and German and Spanish and Italian spoken everywhere, because those people can't start successful companies back in Europe. They all come to the United States because, for all the hysteria about threats to the open internet here, we actually do have an open internet. And it's open not because of net neutrality regulation or other forms of government intervention, but because of Section 230. That 1996 law that I think is the bedrock of internet freedom in this country, that is made possible every single social platform by not holding them responsible for filtering what their users do. That would not happen without that kind of immunity. And Europe has just gone in exactly the opposite direction.
Maria, to the point of startups paying attention to privacy issues and whether they're doing it in San Francisco or in the EU, it seems like that is an issue that really is at the forefront these days, particularly, you know, the phrase the Internet of Things gets bandied about quite a bit. There are conferences hither and yon about having the various devices in our lives gathering information about us as they try to enhance our lives and existences in various ways. But that privacy baked into these kinds of arrangements isn't necessarily always happening. And it seems like we're perhaps on a collision course, not just for privacy sensibilities in the EU, but I think globally, you know, people are not ready for the day when their car is a repository of data about them that could be mined either for commercial or investigative purposes. And I'm just wondering, as we close out the show here, what your take is on this and what developers, technologists working with these kinds of cutting edge arrangements should be thinking about.
Well, it certainly goes without saying that it's becoming a much bigger issue for tech people generally. And I think a large part of that is down to regulatory bodies such as the EU, legislative bodies in California and states that are privacy focused. And if it wasn't for these types of legal mandates, we wouldn't have such an effort to actually think about privacy at the design stage. So as you point out, with the Internet of Things, this is one of the most important points going forward. And it's something that's being recognized throughout the globe. It's been recognized in the new proposed data protection regulation that we need to have privacy by design here. Now, how is this actually going to play out is really difficult to predict because it's just so complex and the technology is so complex that, you know, lawyers like myself, regulators don't always have the technological understanding to really be able to grasp these issues. So we really have to trust to a large extent and make some efforts to raise awareness amongst the technological community as to ensure that particularly security and data is probably one of the major issues regarding how data is shared between different connected devices, how it's stored in the cloud, how is that protected, and how can we encourage technologists and innovators to think about this at the formation stage as opposed to thinking about it, how am I going to comply with data protection law? Actually, if they set up systems where the data is safe and, you know, where necessary, it's anonymized or protected, then everything should run more efficiently and you won't need to be facing up to the authorities.
Right. Dan Gilmore did an article in The Guardian recently that references a Wired article talking about medical gear in hospitals and that, you know, how that's just not where you think, you know, maybe you're thinking about your car as a place that could gather a lot of personal data about you, certainly your phone, maybe various devices in your house that are chronicling, you know, your day-to-day life. But when you think about something like a drug infusion pump, it's not necessarily the first thing that, you know, the people developing that item would think, gee, we better think about data protection and people's personal information. Yeah. And that's where we need to go as a society, it seems like.
Exactly. So that article is quite apocalyptic in how it frames the issues because we're quite used to this, okay, this term data protection sounds very sanitized, very boring, something that we shouldn't really be concerned with. But when you are thinking about someone potentially hacking into medical equipment to cause, you know, large-scale terrorist attacks or to target an individual, some type of completely technologically carried out assassination, where you have this move from purely intangible electronic attacks to actual physical attacks that could be carried out through insufficient security measures, not complying with all the principles that, you know, we've learned over the years that we've grown to accept as being at least valid in this kind of framed off commercial sense, how they actually could have very real world physical effects on all of us.
All right. Baron, what do you think? Is the market going to take care of this? If we've got the privacy respecting drug infusion pump on the market versus the one that is easily hackable, is that a sufficient? Do you think the market is sufficient to make sure that the privacy respecting one prevails, or where do you stand on this?
Look, there's a role for government here, right? And this is what the Federal Trade Commission does: is if companies really have inadequate data security that really, you know, it does potentially harm consumers, I'm fine with saying that that's an unfair trade practice or that companies have deceived a consumer. So I don't have a problem with the role for government. The question is how is it going to be administered? And this is actually the thing that I'm working on now in general. And I'll spare you the details, but I'll just say that. If you're not going to write down formal regulations because it's too hard to decide what good data security is at any given time, that's okay. You could have a flexible approach, but then the process becomes really important for deciding whether a particular process really is harmful to consumers, because sometimes it is just clearly harmful and it's an easy case. But sometimes it's ambiguous. How much more should a company spend on data security? Sometimes data security, there are trade-offs. I mean, we could have two-step authentication to log into every single website on the internet, and that would make us more secure, but it would also be a nightmare for consumers. So the point is that the regulator in the U.S., that's the Federal Trade Commission, really has to have a careful toolkit for approaching the problem and deciding when it's appropriate to intervene. And right now, they don't have that. They just kind of make it up as they go, and that's very disturbing too.
Yep, I could see where this whole situation is, as you were saying, Maria, and as the Wired article was suggesting, fraught with possibility for missteps and disasters, and that government entities that are designed to prevent that need to do it and need to do it in the right way. We've certainly seen the EU this week taking, as it is wont to do, action toward protection of consumers' privacy. And I'm sure we'll continue to see that develop. Maria, anything further that you want to let us know about from Ireland that would be interesting or relevant to what we've been discussing?
Well, I will make a pitch, if you don't mind, actually.
Sure.
Regarding, here in Maynooth, we're taking part in this Around the World Symposium next week. So we'll be live streaming on surveillance in the digital age from here. And I think it's the University of Alberta and some universities in the UK and everything. So if anyone's interested in following our discussion on that, we'd love to have them.
Sure. Can they follow along with that?
Well, the hashtag is Around the World Symposium, and just Google that and you'll find your answer.
Around the World Symposium.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just to drive it home, we'll make that our second MCLE passphrase for the show. Hashtag Around the World Symposium.
Awesome.
Let's see, I'm getting something on Skype in the background there. And we'll check that out. What is the date?
The 21st.
Wonderful. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and give you a tip and a resource of the week to close out the show. The tip of the week comes from Cash Hill. Again, it jibes very well with the discussion that we've been having about information that people get creeped out by entities having. Shutterfly had a debacle this week where they were attempting to market to new parents and suggesting that birth announcements might be a nice thing for people to purchase. But however they were deciding to send out their blast email and advertising on that, they managed to capture a lot of people who hadn't had children at all. And the whole notion that a site that people are using to share photographs and sort of organize their personal lives, is trying to determine when they've procreated or not, has definitely raised some hackles, not to mention the fact that some of the people that received this notice had, you know, sensitivity about the whole birth process, either, you know, people who had been undergoing fertility treatments for a long time without success, or, you know, recent miscarriages, et cetera, and then to receive a birth amount announcement, really counterproductive on the marketing front. So our tip of the week is be very, very careful if you're going to attempt to sell people baby products, because you're opening up a whole can of worms. Of course, Target has been involved in a whole debacle about this as well. If you're going to be crunching your customers' data for that kind of thing, do it the right way or don't do it at all. And then our resource of the week is a piece in The Economist. This is kind of just for fun. Something kind of sad, though. You know, the great video of Commander Chris Hadfield on the ISS, where he was playing David Bowie's Space Oddity on the space station. He actually, went to the trouble of getting copyright permission for that. The permission that NASA was able to obtain, though, only lasted a year and just expired. So over at The Economist, there's a piece called How Does Copyright Work in Space? And if you have questions about that at all and the process that applied to that video, which we are sad to see go, then check out The Economist article. Maria and Baron, I'm so glad you could join us today. Very busy week, and we couldn't just ask for more informed and enlightening folks to help us get through it all. Maria is a lecturer in privacy and human rights-oriented issues at the National University of Ireland at Maynooth. That's near Dublin, correct?
Yeah, just outside.
Very cool. Well, someday would love to get over there and treat you to a pint of Guinness. But in
Very
the meantime,
welcome.
I'll do it virtually. And just thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Best of luck.
And Baron, great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for helping open our eyes and better understand the tussle and complex range of issues around net neutrality. We will continue, of course, to unpack these issues in the next months as the new open internet rule is open for comment and discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. Anything going on at Tech Freedom? I know you guys always are having good discussions and conferences yourselves.
Well, on Monday, actually, we're doing an event on the IP transition, which is turning telephony into an app over the internet. And that's actually very related to the debate we were having today about net neutrality. So that'll be live streamed at noon. It's going to be on C-SPAN as well. Encourage you to tune in. And as always, we have both sides of a debate, of the debate there. And the fundamental goal is really to explain a complicated issue, what the IP transition is all about, and what it means, why they're doing it, and what the legal issues are, which are, as I said, parallel to the issues we were discussing today, except in that case, it's really a Title II service potentially going to Title I. And really the question is whether you should keep telephony in Title II or use other tools. And we'll be discussing that on Monday.
Thank you so much for flying to your office and getting in there as soon as you could and coming on the show.
Well, I'm sorry for the meltdown. I was literally a little hot, because it was also very hot when I got in here, that no one else was in here today and the air conditioning was off. And
I wouldn't
normally be so quite so obnoxious. And I apologize for the meltdown.
No problem. I think, you know, I was following along, and people following along in chat realize that these are difficult and emotional issues. And I do think, and some of the comments in chat were echoing my thoughts that, you know, even though you and Neil, I were both, you're on opposite sides of this debate, but I think trying to have civilized discourse around it anyway. And so we greatly appreciate that. And folks, if you're not already following along at Tech Freedom, you should. They have their own Twitter account. Barron, of course, is on Twitter as well, as is Maria. I'm on Twitter too. You can reach me there at D Howell. Evan, my co-host, who couldn't join us this week, is Internet Cases over there. Twitter is a great way to get in touch with us, to let us know about topics you'd like to see on the show, guests you'd like to see on the show, feedback about the past shows, suggestions about future shows. We're always on there, so great way to reach us. If you have something more private or requiring more characters, you can email us. He is Evan at twit.tv. I'm Denise at twit.tv. We have a Facebook page and a Google Plus page for the show. Happy to engage over on those forums as well. And we do record the show live every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That's a great time to tune in and see us with warts and all, no editing or post-production. We do some light editing and post-production just to help your ears not bleed too badly for any hiccups we've had during the show. And then we release it on YouTube and in iTunes and various other places, including on our twit.tv site at twit.tv/twill, where you'll find our whole archive of shows going back to the very beginning. So those are always there for you, and we hope you'll check them out and continue to tune in for This Week in Law. Thanks very much for joining us today.